Hey there, Raza, Chicano casters. Yeah, bitches, I'm alive. Damn, Raza, these days, you never know. It ain't the cops, it's the damn virus. But like it or not, I'm here, cabrones, a huevo. So this is Fernando Amador coming to you from Downey, California. And this is Chicano Cast podcast number 43. Today's show is easy, Raza, and I'll tell you why. Well, it's really mostly going to be my son on this episode. Yeah, Fernie the Second. His actual name is Fernando Amador II. Can you believe that? That's a dumb shit parents do when they get married young, start to make babies, and then that young stupid pride kicks in and I want my name to live on. Name living on my ass. We should all just hope to be alive and have a good life, you know, in this crazy ass world. So yeah, he has to suffer with the name. I actually told him to change it if he wants. I don't mind, Raza. I tell him, you actually look like a Michael to me. Or is it a Miguel, Raza? Yeah, Miguel, right? Pinche viejo vendido and my Michael name. But you know what? He does look like a Michael. Really, he does. Orale. Anyway, I digress, Raza. My kid, yeah, Fernie the Second. Wait, just to let you know, I was and am the OG Fernie back from my Bell High School days. Shout out to Bell High School. Hell yeah. Well, anyway, my son Fernie, he needs to record and publish a podcast for some social engineering class as part of his PhD program from, Stony Brook University in New York. So he asked me if I could do him a paro. And because I am, you know, the loving and proud dad that I am, I said, órale, mijo, send it over. MP3-like. No bullshit. Apple formats for me. I'm all about Windows. Yeah, Raza, I'm so cool that I can make some room, you know, for his spit on my hit podcast, right? Órale. Hope you cool Raza can also make some listening time for his 20-minute spiel on John Leguizamo's Latin History for Morons. My kid actually corrects some shit John got wrong, so I hope you like it. Honestly, I never heard neither John's nor my kid's take, so I'm going here on blind faith and daddy pride here too. But before I begin my kid's take, quickly, on the title of my show, El Social Distancer. Raza, I invented social distancing. Really, I was doing that shit way before it was a thing. And not because I wanted to protect myself from any virus, no Raza, but because I was a dick. Órale. Just didn't care about getting too close to people, and touching strangers, no mames, not my thing. Maybe Raza, I'm on the spectrum. Or off the spectrum, or whatever it is. But I'm serious, Raza, about being a dick, not about the spectrum part. Yeah, I'm naturally a shy person. If you only knew how hard it is for me to record this show, I can write the fuck out of it, but performing it? Damn, that takes a lot out of me. The only problem, Raza, is that my shyness usually gets misinterpreted. Yeah, people mistake it for me being a conceited asshole, thinking I'm too good to talk or socialize with them. However, once they get to know me, they all tell me the usual line. Man, I thought you were a conceited fucker, but now that I know you, you're a cool dude. But Raza, it's really shyness. Well, and maybe sometimes dickiness, but anyway, due to that dickiness-shyness thing, I was a social distancer. Raza, way before we had the fucking government mandating us Mexicans not to kiss hello. Which, I am okay with. Orale. Okay, Raza, as I record this show, protests are happening all over our great country. Let's talk about that one on the next show. Sale? A quick shout out to some people who checked in on me just to make sure I was alive during these crazy times. Lena from Whittier. Rocio, who emailed me but I can't email her back. Nikki Cortez, who reached out by giving me a review. As well as a curious lady Chicana, my niece. And even some hater vendido cegueñal, who left me a bad review saying I'm a left-winger ranter and seems to be protecting Trump in his review. Vato, I hope I'm wrong about the protecting Trump thing. But if it's true, you are so damn confused. And yes, Eweñal, change is coming. So reach out to me, Raza. I'm at chicanocast@gmail.com. Now I'll shut up my fat trap. And here you go, Fernie the Second, on correcting John Leguizamo on Latin history. Stay brown and stay proud, Raza.
Hello, listeners. As you might be able to tell, this is not your usual host, Fernando. Let me introduce myself. I'm actually his son, and my name is also Fernando. Typical, right? A Mexican father giving his firstborn son his name, as though I'm going to inherit his land, wealth, and titles or something. But let me tell you more about myself. I grew up in a suburb just outside of LA, and growing up, I always enjoyed learning history. So I got to college and I majored in history. And now I'm a PhD student in history out in Long Island, New York. I moved across the country to the freezing cold. And I'm studying migration history, but from the Mexico side, exploring how migration from Mexico to the US affects Mexico, particularly how migration affects the little towns and ranchos that many of us go to visit during our summer and winter breaks. And from this, I think you can tell that my father and I are different, which I think will keep the podcast interesting. My father is an engineer. I am a historian in training. He's a first generation Chicano, and I'm technically 1.5 or something because apparently because my mother was born in Mexico and my father in the US, that does not make me second generation, but 1.5. It's a little weird, but that's what I've been told. So because of these differences, we will talk about different topics, providing new content, but also we will talk about the same thing and give different perspectives. So for my first episode, I'm going to talk about John Leguizamo's Latin American History for Morons. I watched it for the first time after my cousin, who knows I'm studying history, asked me if I had watched it and what I thought of it. I hadn't watched it yet at that time, so I told him I would, and so I did. And if you don't know who John Leguizamo is, he's a Colombian actor. He's born in Bogota. And I think he's a fantastic actor. He was in John Wick. He was in the series When They See Us. And then in 2017, he came out with his one-man Broadway show called Latin American History for Morons. It's basically about how his son growing up around rich white folks lacked Latino role models. And when Leguizamo realized he didn't know anything about Latin American history, se puso las pilas, he picked up a few books, and started to learn. You can actually watch the show on Netflix now. So if you haven't watched it, I recommend you watch it because I think it's pretty good. But it's not perfect. And after watching it, me dio las ganas to tell people where he falls short, particularly when he's talking about the history of the conquest of the Aztecs. He begins by telling the audience about the city of Tenochtitlan and how it was an urban, complex city that surprised the Spanish and Cortes when they laid eyes on it. Then he asks, how could we lose? Essentially making the point of how could an empire with the ability to create such a large city lose to the Spanish? So that's his big question. ¿Por qué perdimos? Leguizamo puts the blame on germs and the Emperor Moctezuma. My issue isn't really with the germs part, but more with the Moctezuma part, because this is what he says about Moctezuma. Moctezuma, who was polling very low, colludes with Cortez to set him up as the ancient god Quetzalcoatl. Because if Moctezuma could prove that Cortez was a god, then the Aztec people were sure he was there to make the Aztecs great again. Ha. But Moctezuma got played by Cortez, so we have a word in Spanish for Moctezuma, un pendejo. And after he says this, he goes on to do a monologue and song and dance where he depicts Moctezuma in a very feminine, stereotypically exaggerated, homosexual depiction. And the thing I have an issue with is that Leguizamo's wrong. His depiction of Moctezuma is wrong. Placing the blame of the fall of the Aztecs on Moctezuma is wrong, and the idea that the Aztecs thought the Spanish were gods is also wrong. To be fair though, many people believe that Moctezuma was a weak leader, and that the Aztecs thought the Spanish were gods, specifically that Cortez was the god Quetzalcoatl. And this idea that the Aztecs believed the Spanish were gods es falso. One of the first people to ever make this claim was the Spanish guy López de Gomara, who wrote about the conquest of the Aztecs, even though he had never even set foot in Mexico. And the Aztecs didn't even consider Quetzalcoatl one of their gods. was actually a major god for another of the indigenous nations in Mesoamerica. And then we have the famous Florentine Codex, which is a manuscript that recorded the fall of the Aztecs. And it was compiled by a Spanish friar named Sahagún after the fall of Tenochtitlan. He documented the words of the Mexica descendants, not from the people who actually experienced the fall of the empire. And if you don't know this term Mexica, it's the name of the powerful group that controlled the Aztec empire. It's where we get the name Mexico. The most convincing evidence that the Mexica thought the Spanish were gods comes from the word the Mexica used to refer to the Spanish. They used the word Tzotl, which many have come to translate as God. But that's not quite what it means. And to explain, I need to first talk about two other things. Before the Spanish arrived, the Mexica used Tzotl to refer to those who were going to be ritually sacrificed, you know, on top of the pyramids, Mel Gibson style. So we can define it as a person for the gods. The person being sacrificed was a person for the gods, Tzotl. Second, in Mesoamerica, it was common to refer to someone from where they came from. So someone from Tenochtitlan was a Tenochca. It's like we do now. Someone from New York is a New Yorker, or a German is from Germany. But the Mexica did not know where the Spanish came from. And all the Spanish did at that time was talk about their God, how they were doing this for God and glory. So the Mexica started calling them Tzotl because the Spanish claimed to represent their God. So they did not call the Spanish gods, but more person for the gods. Lastly, in his one-man Broadway show, Leguizamo believes that Moctezuma was a pendejo. But he was not a pendejo. And he did not believe that Cortez was the Aztec god Quetzalcoatl. And Moctezuma said to Cortez, "Look at me and see that I am flesh and bones, the same as you and everybody, and that I am mortal and tangible." So Moctezuma saw Cortez as himself. He saw him as a human. So if Moctezuma was not a pendejo, then why did the Aztec Empire fall? And to sort of tell you this history, I want to describe to you how our ancestors and not the Spanish are the fallen heroes. The Mexica are the ones who defended their land from invaders, the ones who wanted to save their loved ones, the ones that John Leguizamo's son should look up to, not the Spanish. Just a note, although I'm going to tell a shortened history, I want you to realize that when Cortez landed in what is now Mexico, there were many different nations and groups, because in many people's minds, they see them all as one. The leaders of the Aztec Empire, the Mexica, were just one nation out of many. There were the Tlaxcalans, Chontals, Cholulas, yeah, like the Hotzas, and Huetzilocincos. I want to emphasize this point because many people have created this image of the Americas as though it was just one monolithic group. And we constantly then tend to wonder why the indigenous peoples turned on themselves instead of facing the Spanish together. This is a strange view to have because we don't see Europe the same way. For instance, the French and British were killing each other for hundreds of years, yet we don't see this as, oh, they were killing themselves, because we understand these are two nations with different cultures, languages, history, and people. And it's a similar case in Mesoamerica. It was made up of different nations where some got along with each other and others did not. And the most powerful before the Spanish arrived were the Mexica, who ruled an empire. When Cortez landed in the Yucatan Peninsula in 1519, he met resistance and fought with the Chontal and Tlaxcalan nations, eventually making peace and becoming allies with both. From these indigenous allies, he learned about the wealthy Mexica nation and their capital of Tenochtitlan, what is now Mexico City. And Cortez decided he wanted their riches. While this was going on, Moctezuma was in the capital, where he learned about the arrival and victory of the Spanish over the Chontal and Tlaxcalan. He decided to assemble a war council, and he sent scouts to patrol everything between Tenochtitlan and the coast. He constantly received new information about the Spanish, to the point that when he finally met them, Moctezuma interrupted the priest's sermons because he said he had already heard it. When Moctezuma heard that Cortez had made alliances with the Chontals and Tlaxcalans, he sent gifts and offered Cortez annual tribute as long as he did not enter Mexica lands. Many people might now want to say that Moctezuma was a coward for not wanting to confront the Spanish and choosing to bribe them away. But let's put ourselves in his place. A strange force has defeated armies twice their size and turned your enemies into their allies, now having gotten stronger. You can gather your forces to fight, and there's the possibility that you will win, but it will surely come at a high cost. And this costly victory will show your allies you're not that strong, and they might turn on you, and your enemies might strike in your weakened state. Besides war, the other option is to see if you can get these newcomers to leave by giving them what they seem to want most, gold. Moctezuma decided to offer them what they wanted. However, Cortes turned down these gifts and continued towards Tenochtitlan. In the Valley of Mexico lies an enormous lake, and rising from the lake was the stone city of Tenochtitlan. The massive city had hundreds of buildings, thousands of people filling the streets, countless boats on the canals that cut through the city's neighborhoods, and many active shoppers in the markets, or what they, and many of us still call, tianguis. At the center of the city was a large temple comparable to palaces in Spain. The Spanish were so enchanted that they asked if they were dreaming, because they never could have imagined discovering a place like this. The Spanish made their way to the center of the city when a large group of men walked toward them. Clearly standing out amongst them was Moctezuma. When Moctezuma reached Cortes, they stood just a few feet apart. Cortes decided to move forward and embrace Moctezuma, but Moctezuma's retainers quickly moved to stop him. After a few seconds of marked tension, they exchanged gifts. Cortes gave Moctezuma pearls, and Moctezuma gave Cortes gold. He then instructed Cortes to follow him where they spoke. No one truly knows what the two men said to each other. Cortes claimed that Moctezuma surrendered, but we only have Cortes' account, and we know that Cortes was a mentiroso. And it's also possible that Cortes may have misunderstood Moctezuma, who was just being polite. Apparently, Moctezuma told Cortes that he was at Cortes' command. But this was also just typical polite behavior of that time and region. It's similar to when we say, a sus órdenes, or mi casa es su casa. We say this out of politeness, not because we will literally follow any command we are given, or are giving our homes away to our guests. But after Moctezuma kept ruling the empire, and hosting the Spanish and Tlaxcalan guests, so to speak, for months. And these guests were costing Moctezuma the city a fortune. And they were not great guests. The Spanish walked around, took what they wanted, caused trouble in the markets, and were acting like jerks. In 1520, Moctezuma received news that 800 Spaniards on 13 ships had landed on the coast. He decided to tell Cortes to see how he would react, and this was a smart move, because Cortes clearly showed panic. You see, Cortes had left Cuba after the governor, Diego de Velázquez, had told him to stay. Now, some of you might be a little confused, because Diego de Velázquez is also the name of a famous painter. These two individuals had the same name, but I'm talking about the governor of Cuba, not the painter. So pissed off that Cortes had disobeyed him, Velázquez sent an expedition to arrest Cortes. When Moctezuma told Cortes about the Spanish expedition on the coast, Cortes knew it was Governor Velázquez's men sent to arrest him. Cortes's obvious concern proved to Moctezuma that a rivalry existed between Cortes and Governor Velázquez. Moctezuma saw an opportunity to divide the Spanish and expel them, so he called for war preparations, but he was still uncertain whether to side with Cortes or Governor Velázquez. And Cortes grew anxious about the new large force sent to capture him, and he decided to do something drastic. He went to go see Moctezuma, and suddenly he took him by surprise. He put a knife to his throat, forced him back to the palace that the Spanish were staying in, and placed him in iron shackles. Cortes had him guarded 24 hours of the day, and threatened that any order to his people to resist would mean his death. Cortes then took the majority of his men and indigenous allies to the coast, leaving a small garrison behind in Tenochtitlan to guard Moctezuma. Cortes quickly made his way and then sent messages to men in the expedition who were not quite loyal to Governor Velázquez to join him and share in the gold and glory. Cortes's words seemed to have worked, because as soon as he attacked and captured the expedition's leader, the fighting stopped. The men sent to arrest Cortes then decided to join him. Cortez now had 800 more men, 80 more horses, and many more supplies. But this victory was short-lived. Cortez soon learned that the Mexica were in open rebellion. As soon as Cortez had left to the coast, the Mexica in Tenochtitlan were preparing for an important religious holiday and festival. The Spanish garrison was worried the Mexica were using the festival as a cover to launch an attack. Therefore, the Spanish garrison decided to attack first. During the day of the festival, people were singing, dancing, and playing instruments in a large courtyard. Suddenly, Spanish soldiers appeared at every entrance of the courtyard in full armor and equipped with swords, lances, and shields. They began killing those that tried to flee past them. Then they moved into the courtyard. And we actually have a first-hand account of what happened.
The Spanish surrounded those who were dancing, going among the cylindrical drums. They struck a drummer's arms. Both of his hands were severed. Then they struck his neck. His head landed far away. Then they stabbed everyone with iron lances and struck them with iron swords. They struck some in the belly, and then their entrails came spilling out. Those who tried to escape could go nowhere. When anyone tried to go out, at the entryways, they struck and stabbed him.
A few managed to flee by climbing over walls or hiding in nearby buildings. When news spread across the city of the massacre, the Mexica warriors cried out for retaliation. The Spanish and Tlaxcala allies grew concerned and fortified the palace they were staying in. The Mexica charged and attacked the makeshift fortress but could not breach it. After this initial attack failed, the Mexica changed tactics. Instead of directly attacking the fortress, they began to transform the city. They widened the canals, built more walls, and obstacles around the city to make it harder to move around. They knew Cortez would soon show up, and the Mexica were getting ready for urban warfare. As soon as Cortez heard the news that his garrison was under siege, he hurried back. When Cortez arrived at Tenochtitlan, it was quite different from the first time. Whereas before the city was bustling with people, now the streets were completely empty, and not a soul could be found in the streets. They walked through the empty city and reached the fortress where the Spanish garrison felt relieved to see help finally arrive. After a few weeks of waiting for the Spanish to grow hungry, the Mexica attacked. For 7 days, the Mexica fought as soon as the sun rose and stopped only when it got too dark to see. They could not penetrate the fortress but kept trying. Moctezuma, still held by the Spanish, tried to calm and stop the fighting by shouting from the top of the fortress. Now, a lot of you right now might be thinking, why did Moctezuma tell his people to stop? Why wasn't he telling them to keep going, to keep fighting? But the historian Camilla Townsend brings up a good point as to why Moctezuma wanted the fighting to stop. Although many people have tried to argue that Moctezuma was a coward who only wanted to save himself, people like John Leguizamo, Townsend points out that the most important duty of a Mexica leader was to care for and save the lives of his people so that the nation could survive and have future generations. So a stubborn, arrogant, or as Leguizamo might say, a pendejo that tried to wage unwinnable wars would be considered a terrible ruler, even by our standards. In addition, Townsend brings up the point that Moctezuma had fought and won countless battles before the Spanish arrived. He had experience. He had ruled an empire that contained thousands of people for 18 years. He knew warfare. He knew strategy. He knew how the other indigenous nations hated the Mexica. He knew more Spanish people would eventually come. And most importantly, he knew that in a long-term war, the Spanish would eventually win. As Townsend puts it, shouting from the top of the fortress, Moctezuma was simply telling his people the truth as he saw it. And his truth turned out to be correct because the Aztecs would eventually lose against the Spanish. Yet at this moment, the city residents and Mexica warriors had had enough. They attacked for 7 days, seeking blood and telling the Spanish that even if 25,000 of them died for every Spaniard, they would still win. And Cortez realized his army had to escape to survive. Because Tenochtitlan rested on a lake, the city had long causeways, similar to bridges built over the lake that connected the city to the lakeshore. All of the causeways had been destroyed except one, and the one surviving causeway had missing sections. To aid in their escape, the Spanish built a portable bridge to use and retract whenever they came across gaps on the causeway. At midnight on the seventh day, the Spanish decided to sneak out of the city. Lucky for them, the rain covered some of the sound they made as they opened the makeshift gate and made their way out of their fortress and into the streets. The city was dark, empty, and quiet. Cortes had organized and disciplined the Spaniards, servants, and allies to ensure a quick escape without raising any alarms. They left their fortress and arrived at the edge of the city to the only causeway left that could lead them out of the city. When they came across the first gap in the causeway, they used the bridge that they made. But then they couldn't retract it, so they left it and had to rely on beams they brought along. And just as they were making their way over the causeway, a young Mexica woman woke up. She looked out, saw them, started shouting, and raised the alarm. Immediately, the quiet escape in the calm night turned into a chaotic rout. Warriors came from all sides, from the streets behind the Spanish, sailing on canoes, all trying to stop and kill their enemy. Those on the canoes tried to destroy the makeshift bridges the Spanish used, and then they also went under the causeway to stab their enemies from below. And during this panic, the escapees tried to push forward, but the few beams used on the second gap in the causeway couldn't hold everyone, and many fell into the lake and drowned. And many Spaniards drowned simply because they refused to let go of the gold that weighed them down. So many bodies began to accumulate in the water that eventually others trying to flee simply stepped on the bodies to get across. In the end, over 600 Spaniards died, and at least twice as many Tlaxcalan allies. The most notable death of the night, however, was Moctezuma. It's unsure whether Cortes ordered his death before he slipped out of the fortress, or if the Mexica killed him out of anger during the battle. No one really knows. Historians don't really know yet. This night later became known as the Noche Triste. Of course, it was a sad night for Cortes and the Spanish, but not for the Mexica. Apparently, Cortes began to tear up seeing his men slaughtered and drowning. And even though historians use this term to describe this event, the term is one-sided. I don't think of it as a sad night. I think of it as a victory, a show of power and dedication on behalf of the Mexica, who sought to reclaim their home. So we shouldn't call it the Noche Triste. The Noche Alegre is more like it. Before I end, I want to bring up a point I made in the beginning. I began this episode talking about my issues with Leguizamo's depiction of Moctezuma and how he and other people, including scholars, have depicted him as a coward, traitor, or just ignorant. But I hope you come to see that Moctezuma acted as a strategist, always trying to figure out what was best not only for him but for his people, because he knew and realized that the Mexica had many enemies and more Spaniards with horses and steel would show up. Moctezuma thought war would only end in disaster, and he was right. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. The information came from Camila Townsend's new book, Fifth Son, A New Aztec History. It's a great read, easy to get through, and I highly recommend it. If you want to hear the rest of the history of the fall of the Aztec Empire or any other topics, please contact us. Have a good one, and I'll see you all soon.
Hey, Dad, since this podcast has a lot of my content, can you end it with my favorite oldie song?
Sure, son. What song is that?
The Clash, Train in Vain.
Nah, boy. I was thinking Lana Del Rey, Doing Time.
Dad, you always play that song over and over when you get drunk.
Okay, son. Don't embarrass me in front of company. Here you go. Train in Vain. Now go play with your friends.
Pinche viejo borracho.
Ni madres, wait. Hey, get me another beer.
Summertime, and the living's easy. Rallies on the microphone with Ross MG. All the people in the dance will agree that we're well qualified to represent the LBC. Me and Louis, we gonna run to the party and dance to the rhythm, it gets harder. Take this veil from off my eyes.